But the more his real-world attempts at intimacy failed, the more his fantasies changed. Instead of romantic love and sexual compatibility, he imagined punishing the women who shunned him, the bosses who sacked him, and the bullies who bullied him. In his imagination, he didn't just get the girl, he made her pay. He made them all pay. Fantasies of sexual revenge have to be fed. Pornography and violent films provided some of what he needed, but soon it wasn't enough. He sought out real-world details, locations, victims, souvenirs. He began following women home, or stealing underwear from their clotheslines, or peeping through their windows. When he did approach women, they tended to be young and impressionable, and easier to talk into having sex. All of this behaviour is part of a progression, yet raping and killing Jodie was way ahead of anything he'd done previously. Something must have triggered the escalation. A family tragedy? Getting fired from a job? Some unexpected setback or humiliation? If I were asking the questions, I would take my time, but the police don't have that luxury. Unless they seek an extension from a judge, they have 24 hours to either charge Farley or let him go. After 2 hours, the team takes a break. Lenny arrives in the observation room. She looks pleased with how it's gone. Farley is still in the interview room, pacing the floor, muttering to himself.
"What do you think?" she asks.
"I think you'll get a confession." She waits, expecting more. "I think he's highly suggestible."
"We're not putting words in his mouth."
"Pushed hard enough, he'll say almost anything." Lenny frowns so deeply that her eyes disappear. She's angry in a hip-jutting, pissed-off way.
"He's not going to make up a murder."
"I know, but you'll get his DNA and fibres from his clothes. You don't have to break him. Farley is isolated and confused. The adrenaline rush that led him to raping Jodie has disappeared, and he's realising the magnitude of what he's done. Of what he is."
"You think he's a suicide risk?"
"Yes."
"Saving us a lot of time and expense."
"I'll pretend I didn't hear that." Chapter 19.
"Christ, that's all I need,"
mutters Lenny, looking through the glass doors of the station. A crowd has gathered on the pavement, spilling onto the road.
"They've been arriving for the past hour," says a uniformed sergeant. "That's because this place leaks like a church roof," grunts Lenny.
I recognise Felix Sheehan among the crowd. He's with another young man and two teenage girls who look school age but are dressed to look older, or colder, depending on what you consider functional or fashionable. Two uniformed officers are guarding the main doors. One of the protesters yells, "What's his name? Has he confessed?" Others react and begin chanting, "Bring him out! Bring him out!" I notice a TV crew arriving, hoisting cameras onto shoulders and bathing the crowd in a spotlight. The escalation is immediate, and the noise level increases. I've always been fascinated by the psychology of the mob, how it provides anonymity and abrogates responsibility and diminishes any sense of self. People don't lose their identity when they join together. They gain a new one as part of a tribe.
"Get some more bodies down here,"
mutters Lenny, pushing through the glass doors. Cameras fire and reporters jostle to get to the front.
"I'll make a short statement, then I want you all to leave," she says. "A local man has been taken into custody and is helping us with our inquiries into the murder of Jodie Sheehan. That is all I can say."
"Who is he?"
yells one of them.
"We won't be releasing his name."
"Let us talk to him."
The statement triggers laughter. Lenny continues.
"Please, go home. Let us do our job."
"We have every right to be here,"
yells the ringleader, who has tattoos on his shaven head and a t-shirt that says "Freedom isn't free" with a picture of Tommy Robinson, the far-right activist, emblazoned on a Union Jack flag. Lenny ignores him. The crowd starts chanting, "Scum! Scum! Scum!" I notice Felix slipping back through the bodies, trying to fade into the background. Stepping out of the main doors, I walk along the pavement, skirting the crowd, keeping him in sight among the heads. I spy him crossing the road.
ducking between stopped cars. He's with the same group, the young man and teenage girls. I follow from a distance, watching them saunter along Rectory Road, slouching and smoking. Felix has his arms around the two girls, sliding his hands down their spines until his fingers tuck into the pockets of the denim shorts. I want to talk to him. I want to ask about the money we found in Jody's locker, but now isn't the time. Instead, I follow him from a distance. This is how I learn things about people. I watch them. I study the way they walk and talk and interact with the world. When a structural engineer looks at a bridge or a building, he automatically thinks about axial forces, load-bearing points, and tensile strength. I look at how people use their bodies, faces, and voices, what they wear, how they drive their cars and relate to each other. Without trying or wanting to, I learn things about them. Not the detail of their lives, but the shape of their personality and what influences their behaviour. I'm not far behind Felix. I half expect him to notice me and turn, but he's too busy flirting with the girls. He's reached his Lexus. My ageing red Fiat is parked opposite. That's when I make the decision. I cross the road and open the car door while Felix says goodbye, bumping fists and shoulders. One of the girls whispers something in his ear. He brushes her off. I've never tailed a car before. It's not like following someone home from the pub or to a picnic spot in the countryside. Felix drives impatiently, accelerating hard between lights. Twice I think I've lost him, but the traffic is so heavy that he can't get too far ahead of me. We cross Trent Bridge and follow London Road past Meadow Lane Stadium before turning left into Queen's Road. He pulls into a multi-story car park near Nottingham Railway Station and drives to the rooftop level. He parks and locks the Lexus, twirling the keyless fob around his forefinger as he walks quickly down the stairs. I can hear his footsteps echoing below me, masking the sound of my own progress. I emerge 30 yards behind him, watching him enter the station concourse, past the taxi rank and through the automatic doors. He stands beneath the arrivals and departures board, but isn't studying the timetable. Instead, he seems to be looking for someone. Maybe he arranged to pick them up. He walks slowly along the concourse, checking out the cafes, the booking hall, and the men's toilets. Beside a row of vending machines, he stops and studies two backpackers who are lying on the floor with their heads resting on their rucksacks. Felix says something. A baseball cap is lifted, a shake of the head. Leaving the main entrance, he crosses Station Street to a Job Centre Plus on the opposite side of the road. The automatic doors open to reveal a queue of job seekers waiting for interviews. Felix loiters near the access ramp, watching people arrive and leave. Occasionally, he approaches one of them, but the conversations are brief. Another youth emerges, hands in pockets, a hooded sweatshirt covering his head. Felix greets him, his face full of boyish good cheer. A cigarette is offered, accepted, lit. Exhaled smoke mingles and dissipates in the cool air. They don't know each other. This is a first meeting. They chat for a few minutes before Felix reaches into his pocket and takes out a pen. He motions for the teenager to pull up his sleeve and then writes something on his forearm. A phone number? An address? I'm too far away to see. They separate. The youth doesn't look back. Felix checks his phone, types, two-handed. Seemingly satisfied, he turns away from the job centre and heads back to the railway station. I'm not exactly sure what I've just witnessed. Some sort of recruitment or business arrangement? I still want to ask Felix about the money in Jody's locker, but not now. Not yet. I don't want him to know that I followed him. He's passing a homeless man, dozing beside a dog. Felix pauses and takes a £10 note from a money clip and tucks it into the man's pocket, before walking away with a lightness to his step, as though all is now right with the world. Chapter 20. Wednesday morning, and the wind hints of winter. Mottled clouds are being driven across the sky, heading towards the Peak District and beyond to Ireland. I had planned on going for a run, but quickly went off the idea when I saw the temperature outside. The central heating didn't trigger again. The pilot light had gone out.
It takes 20 minutes and a sore thumb before the spark becomes a solid blue flame. I order a cab for 9 o'clock and slide into the back seat. The driver is listening to the radio. I can only see the back of his head, which is shaved and oiled, and the colour of an old leather football. A hospital porter has been charged with the rape and murder of Nottingham schoolgirl Jodie Sheehan, whose body was found a week ago beside a local footpath. Craig Farley, aged 26, was arrested on Sunday at his Bainton Grove bungalow, which is less than a mile from where Jodie's body was discovered. At a press conference held late yesterday, Detective Chief Inspector Lenore Parvel said that Farley had made a full confession and would appear in Nottingham Crown Court this morning. I hear Lenny's voice take over the commentary.
By choosing to cooperate with the police, the suspect has spared Jodie's family added heartache. I would like to thank my team, who have had very little sleep over the past week. This quick arrest is down to their professionalism and hard work. They did it for Jodie and for everyone whose life she touched. We cannot bring her back, but we can make sure she's not forgotten.
The driver is talking to me. Sorry, did you say something? I ask. He nods towards the radio.
Me and my mates got it wrong.
About what?
Jodie Sheehan. We figured it was going to be family, you know, someone close to her.
Any particular reason?
Normally is, eh? 80% of the time.
Where do people get figures like this? He's waiting for me to agree with him. Do you know the family? I ask.
But the old man, he's a cranky prick.
I want to say the name Dougal Sheehan, but leave it unsaid.
He's one of us, a cabbie, says the driver. Had some trouble a while back. This woman complained that he assaulted her. He'd driven her all the way out to Calverton before she told him she couldn't pay. Said her purse had been stolen. Dougal threatened to call the cops, but she got in first and accused him of holding her hostage. She had bruises on her arm. Could have been Dougal did it. Could have been her boyfriend.
What happened?
Never went to court.
He glances into the rearview mirror.
That's why I got myself one of these.
He points to a small box on my dashboard.
You're on candid camera. Say cheese.
We're heading along Derby Road, past Lenton Abbey and the University. Taking the first exit on a roundabout, we cross the River Lean, little more than a concrete culvert, and follow Abbey Street. The plane trees form a golden tunnel that is crumbling in the wind, and between the branches I get a glimpse of Nottingham Castle perched on the aptly named Castle Rock. Having been conquered, razed, rebuilt, and conquered again, it now looks more like a grand house than a fortress with turrets and battlements. The cab drops me outside the Crown Court, a modern building with an arched glass entrance. TV crews are sheltering inside the main foyer, away from the wind. They have set up their cameras in front of the large coat of arms, ready for reporters to cross live to the studio with news of Craig Farley's first court appearance. High court hearings are in a different part of the building. Evie Cormack's case has been listed for 10:30. I try to imagine her being anxious, but it's not an emotion I associate with Evie. The corridors are bustling with lawyers and clients. This part of the precinct handles family law matters, divorces and child custody applications. I recognise the couples because they avoid eye contact, while their respective lawyers mingle with each other, chatting and smiling. Marriages that began with heartfelt promises to love and honour and respect have been reduced to ring-bound folders that detail who gets what and when and where. The arguments have led to this, a hearing before a judge who will undo what God put together and no man was meant to put asunder. I spot Caroline Fairfax. She is wearing her court clothes, a matching skirt and jacket, both black, over a white-collared blouse. As I draw nearer, I realise that she's not alone. Details slowly register. The freckles, bird-like skeleton, and upturned nose. Evie has been transformed. Her hair is dyed to a more natural colour, and she's wearing a dress and cardigan buttoned up to her neck. Ankle-length boots give her another few inches in height. She looks great, yet miserable, as though forced to wear sackcloth or a hair shirt. I smile.
What are you looking at?
she snaps.
Doesn't she look great?
Says Caroline.
I nod. Evie tells me to fuck off.
You have to stop doing that,
says Caroline.
What? Swearing. It can't happen in the courtroom. I'm not a complete moron,
says Evie, who tugs at the collar of her cardigan and adjusts the elastic of her knickers in a less than ladylike manner. Caroline must have helped her with her makeup, which is understated and subtle, rather than plastered on with a trowel. I hear someone call my name. Guthrie waves to me, wanting me to join him. He's standing with two men, lawyer types in charcoal grey suits. By comparison, the social worker is his usual slovenly self in baggy corduroy trousers and a tweed jacket with a canary yellow fleck that makes his skin look jaundiced. The taller of the lawyers introduces himself as Derek Hodge, QC, the silk representing Nottingham City Council. His colleague is the instructing solicitor, Stephen Carter. Hodge has a finger-mangling handshake and a way of leaning forward, as though trying to intimidate or establish the pecking order. Carter has his arms full of ring-bound folders and can only nod a greeting.
It's good that you're here, says Guthrie. Mr. Hodge wants to call you as a witness.
Me?
Evie Cormack wouldn't agree to see a court-appointed psychologist, but I told him that you'd spoken to her.
I've met her twice, not in a clinical setting.
But you were there during the knifing incident,
says Hodge, looking at me straight and steady, as if to say, no pretending, no ducking out.
What difference does that make?
Hodge answers.
Evie Cormack asked a highly agitated adolescent to stab her.
That's not what happened.
His right eyebrow arches up his forehead as though trying to join his hairline.
I've seen the CCTV footage. She points the knife at her heart and pulls it towards her chest.
She disarmed him.
She asked the young man to stab her.
She knew he wouldn't do it.
And you know this because...
She told me.
Hodge chuckles without warmth or humour, and I realise that I don't like him.
I'm not comfortable giving evidence, I say. I only came to observe.
On whose behalf?
Mine. Guthrie looks embarrassed for me.
I thought you wanted to help Evie.
I do.
Don't worry about it, says the barrister. The judge has Evie's history and the written submissions, which should be more than enough.
He glances towards Caroline.
And we're not facing the big guns.
I like him even less. A loudspeaker interrupts us. The case is being called. Hodge nods at the solicitor.
This shouldn't take long.
The hearing is closed to the public to protect Evie's identity and the details of her past. I'm allowed to sit in a small public gallery because I'm a court-accredited expert witness, whether I give evidence or not. Caroline and Evie take chairs at one end of the bar table, while Hodge and Carter are at the other. Guthrie sits close behind them, ready to consult or pass notes. Judge Sale enters through a side door. Middle-aged, with tea-black hair and strangely grey eyebrows, he smiles and welcomes everyone, making a note of their names before addressing Evie directly.
It's nice to meet you, Miss Cormack. I know this place may seem intimidating, but we're not here to punish or repudiate anyone. This is a safe space where you can speak freely and honestly.
He then addresses the lawyers.
I'm sure you all appreciate the strict secrecy provisions that apply in this case. I have read all the relevant submissions and will give each of you an opportunity to present closing arguments before I make my ruling. I would also like to hear from Evie, if that's all right with you.
Evie doesn't react, but seems to be holding herself in check.
Perhaps you'd like to begin, Miss Fairfax,
says the judge. Caroline gets to her feet and gives Evie a fleeting look. She consults her notes and pulls back her shoulders.
Evie Cormack became a ward of this court 6 years ago, after all attempts to establish her identity and find her family proved fruitless. It was hoped that eventually somebody would come forward, or that Evie would be successfully fostered or adopted, but none of these things have occurred. Normally, care orders are put in place because a child is believed to be at risk of suffering significant harm. In Evie's case, that harm had already been done. She was discovered in a house in North London, hiding in a secret room. She was dirty, malnourished, and suffering from rickets, among other ailments.
Hodge gets to his feet.
Your Honour, I hope my learned friend isn't planning to give us a complete history lesson. None of these facts are in dispute.
But they are,
says Caroline.
The most important fact, Evie's age.
Judge Sale motions her to continue.
Your Honour, the duty of care exists in common law, derived from the historic judgments made by the courts, that places an obligation upon an individual or organisation to take proper care of a child, or to avoid causing foreseeable harm. In the case of Evie Cormack, the local authority has done that job, and she is now asking to be released because she is 18.
She could be 16,
interrupts Hodge, twirling a pen across his knuckles.
Or 19,
counters Caroline.
My client is an adult and wants to be treated like an adult.
She can't have it both ways, says Hodge. She is trying to divorce the local authority like a child divorcing a parent.
What case law can she use to seek redress?
Argues Caroline.
Perhaps if she'd acted more like an adult,
says Hodge, who has stayed on his feet. Caroline tries to object, but Hodge ignores her.
Setting aside the issue of Evie Cormack's age, we cannot ignore her mental fitness and her propensity for self-harm and violence. On 12 occasions, she has been fostered by safe, stable, loving families, but each time she has chosen to fight the system. She has run away from care at least 20 times, going missing for weeks at a time, stealing, taking drugs, gambling, drinking, abusing police, resisting arrest.
Now who's giving a history lesson?
Asks Caroline.
A very pertinent one, Miss Fairfax,
chides Hodge.
Evie Cormack has spent the past 4 years in a high-security children's home because of her refusal to obey the rules, or, dare I say, to act her age. She has abused staff, her peers, mental health care workers, therapists, psychologists, and psychiatrists, many of whom have provided submissions to Your Honour. Evie's case officer is in court today, and he regards Evie as the most damaged child he has ever encountered. Only last week she was involved in a malicious wounding incident at Langford Hall, where she grabbed a knife, pointed it at her heart, and asked a highly disturbed young man to kill her.
Evie disarmed the man,
says Caroline,
by offering herself as a victim.
It was a ploy.
Hodge snorts and waves his hand dismissively, as though Caroline were resorting to semantics.
Evie Cormack is not mature enough or stable enough to be released from care. She has no means of support, no job training, or anywhere to live. I should also point out that crime figures show that children in care go on to make up a disproportionate percentage of our prison population.
Hardly a glowing endorsement of local authority care,
says Caroline.
The onus is not on the council to prove Evie Cormack's age,
says Hodge.
Whose job is it?
Her own. It is Mr. Guthrie's submission that Evie Cormack knows her real name and her age, but refuses to cooperate. She is her own worst enemy. She is not ready to be released from care, and even if she were deemed to be an adult in this court today, the local authority has instructed me to immediately seek to have her sectioned under the Mental Health Act and sent to a secure psychiatric hospital.
That's outrageous,
argues Caroline.
You can't fucking do that,
yells Evie, leaping to her feet. Her chair topples over with a bang. She is on the bar table, crawling towards Hodge, as though ready to rip out his throat. Caroline has to pull her back, holding her around the waist. Evie is so small that Caroline lifts her easily, but has to avoid her kicking feet. Hodge is backed away.
I think that proves my point.
You're a fuckwit,
screams Evie.
Please be quiet,
Caroline pleads, glancing helplessly at me. Judge Sale waits until Evie is back in her chair before warning her, there can be no more outbursts. Evie's shoulders are shaking with rage, or maybe she's crying. I can't see her face. The judge opens a folder and turns the pages. A glimpse note scrawled in the margins and paragraphs that are underlined.
"I'd like you to approach the bench, Miss Cormack," he says. "Come up and take a seat."
Evie stands awkwardly, slightly pigeon-toed, and looks over her shoulder as she makes her way forward. The judge points to a wooden chair, which has been positioned to be on the same level as his own seat.
"I'm sorry you had to listen to that," he says gently. "It can't be easy hearing yourself described in such a way."
Evie doesn't answer.
"I have read your application, and I think I understand how you feel. Children are taken into care for many reasons, primarily due to parental abuse or neglect, but also because there is nobody else to look after them. Your case was considered to be so serious that you were made a ward of this court, and we are your guardians."
Sitting with her back straight and knees together, Evie listens with a disquieting intensity.
"Do you know how old you are?" he asks.
18.
"When were you born?"
"I can't tell you the exact date."
"You look small for your age."
"You look young to be a judge."
He smiles at that.
"I have at least 8 statements here from child care experts who say you're a danger to yourself and a risk to the community."
"I'm not."
"In fact, the only submission that supports your application was delivered to me yesterday."
Judge Sale searches his folder and fumbles to put his glasses on his nose.
"The one person who thinks you are mature and stable enough to be released is a psychologist, a Dr. Haven."
Evie turns her head to look at me. Caroline does the same. For the briefest of moments, I'm the subject of everyone's attention, until Judge Sale reclaims the focus.
"What will you do, Evie? Where will you live?"
"I want to go to London and get a job."
"You have no qualifications or record of employment. You don't have a national insurance number or a bank account or any savings. Mr. Hodge may be right. You could be 16.
"People get married at 16.
"With parental consent."
"They join the army?"
"If their parents approve."
Evie stops. She's not winning the argument. Judge Sale continues.
"I could order you emancipated, but only if you could prove that you are economically self-sufficient and emotionally capable of living alone, or going to a home environment that is entirely suitable for a minor."
"I'm 18.
"But you can't prove it."
"Neither can anyone else."
"Exactly. That's the rub, isn't it?"
Judge Sale takes off his glasses and pulls a cloth from his pocket, breathing on each lens before polishing them.
"I don't want to see you remain in care, Evie, but I don't have any alternative, unless you can find the means to support yourself or can prove your real age."
Evie is shaking her head from side to side. I expect anger or an explosion. Instead, I see tears prickle at the corners of her eyes, but she refuses to let them fall. Hodge grins triumphantly. Judge Sale hooks the glasses over his ears, jotting notes as he talks.
"I have decided to nominate a birth date for the appellant, Evie Cormack. According to the records, she was found on September the 6th, 6 years ago. For that reason, I'm going to nominate September the 6th next year as the date that she turns 18. In the meantime, she will remain in council care."
He addresses Evie.
"Use that time well, young lady. Listen to your counsellors, study hard, and sort through your issues."
Evie is staring right through Judge Sale, as if unable or unwilling to believe how quickly her fate has been decided, the speed of the decision, the complete reversal. Instinctively, I realise this isn't over, that some unseen part of Evie's personality is stirring, uncoiling, waiting for the right moment to vent her fury upon the world. Chapter 21. Angel Face.
The hate climbs inside me. It rises from my stomach, into my throat, up my neck, to my cheeks. In the near silence of the courtroom, I want to scream. I want to hurt someone. I want blood and carnage and destruction. Willing myself to stand, I make my way back to the bar table. Caroline touches my arm. I pull away as if scolded. Instantly, I loathe this woman with her blemish-free skin and her expensive clothes and her lovely straight hair that smells of coconut. Who has had everything handed to her by an accident of birth, born into the right family, sent to the best schools, taken on holidays abroad, given ballet and violin lessons. Everything has come easily to her. University, a career, and a fiancé. I bet Mummy and Daddy helped her buy a flat. Even her name, Caroline Fairfax, sounds like it belongs to a film star or a fashion designer. I hate her. I hate all of them. The judge and Guthrie and the braying lawyers. Fuckwits, dickheads, scumbags. I will not look at them. I will not show my disgust. Why did they raise my hopes and then tear me down? Why not just beat me up, break a few bones, and dump my body in a ditch? Why not swing a fist into my stomach or boot me in the groin? That's what it feels like. I know, because I've been here before. I'm the problem. I'm worthless, detestable, a receptacle for refuse, a sewer, a punch bag, a piñata, a cunt, an ignorant, stinking slit. I cannot escape my past. I'm a child again, sullen and whining, being passed from person to person, greeted like a special delivery, dressed up, painted, pampered, playing a role. Call me Daddy. Call me Uncle Jimmy. Call me Aunt Mary. Yes, Daddy, please, Daddy. Don't hurt me, Daddy. No more. We'll be good next time. In the background, I can hear voices. Cyrus is talking. The judge. Caroline. I'm not listening. Nothing is worth hearing anyway. The cardigan is tight around my neck. The boots are hurting my feet. Suddenly, I picture myself in the same courtroom, this time with a machine gun. I press the trigger, and bullets rattle through the air, punching holes in stomachs and chests and eye sockets, painting the walls with blood and gore. When they're dead, when their bodies are strewn around me, I walk out the door into the corridor, down the stairs, across the foyer, into the street, yelling to the armed guards, "Come and get me! Shoot!" Caroline shakes my shoulder.
"Evie, can you hear me?"
My heart creaks. Cyrus Haven is in the witness box. Why? When did he...
"Dr. Haven wants to know if you'd agree to live with him."
"What?"
"As a foster child."
"I don't understand." Judge Sale speaks.
"Dr. Haven would become your foster carer. Of course, he has to pass the necessary local authority and police checks, but he wants to know if such an arrangement might work for you."
"We haven't talked about it,"
says Cyrus, addressing me directly.
"I appreciate that this offer is quite spur of the moment, and you don't know me well, but I'm serious. I have a big house in Nottingham. It's old and pretty run down, but comfortable. You'd have your own room and bathroom."
"And you'd have to continue your studies," says the judge, "or undertake training or get a job. You will remain a ward of the court until next September, and your foster arrangements will be monitored regularly by the local authority."
I still haven't responded. Where's the catch? I think. Why would he do this? I'm not going to sleep with him. If he lays one finger on me...
"You can't keep running away, Evie,"
says Judge Sale.
"You have to behave yourself until next September."
I look from face to face and back down to the boots that are hurting my feet. I won't talk to him. I'll never tell.
Chapter 22.
What in God's name were you thinking?
Mutters Guthrie in a stage whisper. He is marched to the back of the courtroom, where he wrestles with the door, pushing instead of pulling. Evie and Caroline are still at the bar table. They look like they're arguing. Evie is probably saying the same things as Guthrie.
I asked you to help her, not foster her. You have no idea how dangerous she is.
Evie is glancing in our direction, her eyes full of suspicion, or bloodlust.
Look at her,
says Guthrie, following my gaze.
She's already working out how to destroy you.
It won't be like that.
She broke someone's jaw with a brick. For all we know, she killed Terry Boland.
Now you're being ridiculous.
Within a week, you'll send her back.
No.
Either that or you'll throttle her.
Rubbish.
She'll find your weaknesses, Cyrus. She'll make you question yourself.
Would that be such a bad thing? Guthrie runs his fingers through his hair and makes soft noises by opening and closing his lips.
You can still back out. Tell them you made a mistake.
It's done. Leave Evie alone.
Christ,
he mutters. I thought you'd be pleased. She's not your problem anymore. Then it dawns on me that it was Guthrie who had his jaw broken. He stole the money from Evie and lied about taking it to the police, but she saw through him.
You're going to publish, aren't you?
He says, with a new look in his eyes.
What? You're going to write about Evie Cormack like you're some sort of Oliver Sacks. She'll be your Solomon Sheryshevsky.
He's talking about the famous Russian mnemonist, who could remember astonishing lists of random numbers or words in order, forwards or backwards, even in languages he didn't speak. He was discovered in the 1920s by a neuropsychologist called Alexander Luria, who published a famous book. Guthrie is on a roll.
I thought you were one of the good guys, Cyrus, but you're just another hypocrite. You're going to use Evie like everybody else.
I feel the blood warming in my cheeks and want to throw a quick rabbit punch into Guthrie's soft belly, sending him down, winded and sucking at air. I want to call him a self-deceiving, time-serving public servant who looks for the worst in people unless someone forces him to see the good. Evie isn't a prize that people should be fighting over. Caroline Fairfax is approaching us. Guthrie gives me a look of pity and pushes open the door with a grunt.
What was that all about?
Asks Caroline.
Nothing, I reply, glancing at Evie, who is sitting alone in the courtroom.
She wants to talk to you,
says Caroline.
I nod and suggest we go somewhere for lunch. Caroline offers to pay, calling it a celebration, although Evie doesn't look convinced.
We opt for a restaurant around the corner because it's too cold outside to walk far. Evie sits opposite me. I'm waiting for her to say something, but she stares at her fingernails, which have been picked clean of nail polish. She's not hungry. Caroline orders for her anyway. A hamburger.
I'm a vegetarian,
says Evie, as though it should be obvious.
They have sweet corn fritters.
Evie shrugs. Caroline excuses herself and goes to the ladies, or perhaps she's giving us some privacy.
I don't need a foster carer,
says Evie, sounding out each word like I'm dim-witted.
The judge thought otherwise.
Are you a pervert?
No.
I'm not going to fuck you.
Good.
I wouldn't fuck you for £1 million.
Wow, you are expensive.
I'm coming across as being equally childish, which annoys me.
I'm trying to help you, I say.
But my voice sounds like I'm an exasperated father talking to his daughter. I see her face go fixed and hard, like the bricks of a wall going up.
At least come and have a look, I say.
I won't talk about what happened to me.
Understood?
And I won't play Happy Families.
I don't know that game.
Evie seems to be evaluating me, chewing at her bottom lip.
So, how would this work?
You'll live with me. You'll have your own room and bathroom. It's nothing fancy, but I'm sure you'll cope. We'll share the chores.
I'm not your slave.
I ignore her. I'll pay the bills. You'll study or get a job, in which case I'll charge you board.
Don't you get paid for being a foster carer?
I'm going to save that money for you. You'll get it when you turn 18. As long as you don't steal from me, lie to me, or run away. Caroline returns, taking a seat between us.
I don't think I've ever seen a case turn around like that,
she says, brightly.
I don't have a lot to compare it with, of course. Was any of that planned?
No.
But your letter to the judge?
I wrote it 2 nights ago. Evie has unzipped her boots and is rubbing her heels. I see the blue veins beneath her pale skin on her ankles. She interrupts.
Do you have a dog?
No.
Why not?
I'm away a lot.
I could look after a dog.
You're not with me for long enough.
298 days,
she says, having done the maths.
If you get a dog, I could take it with me.
We're not getting a dog.
And the bussing starts,
she mutters, but doesn't fixate on the rejection. I haven't seen Evie this animated before. Normally our conversations have been stilted and defensive, where each question is treated like a landmine to be avoided or disarmed. I could be winning her trust. I could be deluding myself.
When can I see the house?
She asks.
Why not today?
Asks Caroline. I need to get it ready, clean it up.
Prepare the dungeon in the basement, says Evie.
Very funny.
You said I could see it before I decided.
Okay. We eat lunch. Caroline chats about the case, wanting to replay every highlight, wishing her immediate boss had been there to see it. Evie watches us, as though trying to read something between the words. Occasionally, she wrinkles her nose or makes a spitty sound in her throat, or blows air across the top of her soft drink bottle, making a tooting sound. Caroline disappears to pay the bill. Is everything okay? I ask. Evie leans closer.
You're flirting.
I'm not flirting.
Yes, you are. And she's engaged.
How do you know?
I'm not blind.
Evie holds up her left hand and wiggles her wedding ring finger.
You said you had a girlfriend.
I do.
But you're not sure.
Please don't do that. I look away, which Evie finds amusing. Caroline returns.
What are you two whispering about?
Nothing, I say, too sharply.
Cyrus has a thing for lawyers,
says Evie, with a glint in her eye. Caroline pauses, clearly uncomfortable, and I feel myself shrink in her estimation. I want to shove a serviette in Evie's gob, but I know this is what she does. I can't say that I wasn't warned. Moments later, we're outside on the footpath, buttoning coats, wrapping scarves, and flagging down a cab. I try to remember what state I left the house in this morning. I hope the central heating has stayed on. We retrace the route of my earlier cab ride, past the university and Woolerton Park. As we reach the road, I picture Parkside Avenue through Evie's eyes. It must look like I'm rich, almost posh, until the cab slows and stops. The house appears instantly shabbier than I remember, set amid a dense throng of rambling roses and clematis.
It's huge,
says Caroline, being polite.
It's falling down, says Evie.
It belonged to my grandparents.
Are they dead?
Asks Evie. They've retired to Weymouth.
Can I live with them?
Junk mail tumbles from the mesh basket beneath the mail slot as I open the door.
How long have you lived here?
Asks Caroline, ever the optimist. A little while, I say. 17 years. I give them a tour of the ground floor, the parlour, the study, the library, the drawing room, the kitchen. Evie opens the fridge.
You have no food?
I buy when I'm hungry.
You order takeaway?
No, I can cook. Evie has moved on.
Do you have a computer?
Yes.
Wi-Fi?
Of course.
Can I get a phone?
I don't have one.
What?
I don't like phones.
Evie looks at Caroline as though they've stumbled upon the missing link. I try to explain, but sound like a Luddite.
I'll need a mobile phone, she says, adamantly.
I don't say yes or no, but a part of me is pleased that she's making plans. This might work. Caroline has returned to the drawing room, where the rugs are worn and old furniture gleams with polish. She pulls open the curtains and dust motes dance in the shaft of light. The large fireplace has decorative tiles around the edges of the hearth, and family photographs arranged on the mantelpiece. Most are casual snapshots, random moments captured when the subjects were unaware of the camera. I'm feeding ducks with my mother at Henley, or riding on my father's shoulders, or eating an ice cream on Brighton Pier. My favourite is a black and white portrait of my parents on their wedding day in 1975. My father was 29 and my mother 26. They are doubled over laughing. My mother holds the train of her dress, trying not to drop her bridal bouquet. The only official family portrait was taken in a studio and looks so staged and unnaturally bright that I wonder if the colours were painted in afterwards. Evie seems fascinated by the photograph. She picks it up and traces her fingers over the faces.
What were their names?
I point to each of them.
April and Esme were the twins. They were 7 when this was taken. I was 9. Elias was 15.
Where are they now?
Asks Caroline.
His parents are dead,
replies Evie. She points to my brother.
He did it.
Caroline looks shocked.
What about your sisters?
They're dead too, I say, taking the photograph from Evie.
I place it back on the mantelpiece, arranging it at exactly the same angle as before.
You didn't tell me that,
says Evie, sounding aggrieved.
You didn't ask.
I change the subject.
I'll show you upstairs.
They follow, whispering. Evie is limping from her blisters.
This can be your room, I say, opening the door.
The room has a single bed, a chest of drawers, a wardrobe, and a window that's so dirty we could be underwater. Evie looks unimpressed.
I'll tidy it up, of course, I say.
And get me a new bed.
What's wrong with that one?
Your grandparents probably had sex in it.
This was my bedroom.
Ew, even worse.
Caroline admonishes her. Evie isn't fazed.
Can I redecorate it?
If you wish.
Evie turned in a slow circle, as if mentally measuring up the room and deciding on colour schemes. I can see Caroline having second thoughts.
Are you sure about this?
She whispers.
Why?
Child and Family Services will have to approve everything. This place...
I'll clean it up, I promise.
Evie steps outside the room and glances up the stairs.
What's up there?
It's closed up.
Why?
Because I don't need any more rooms.
Can I see them?
No!
My tone is harsher than I intended. I wish I could take it back. The moment registers with Evie, but she doesn't react. Instead, I imagine her storing it away, stockpiling weapons for later skirmishes.
We should get Evie back to Langford Hall, I say.
I'll take her,
says Caroline.
Downstairs, Evie puts on her old duffel coat, which looks incongruous with her new clothes.
Caroline gives me a quick hug, and Evie hesitates, wondering if she should do the same. Her arms go up and out, but never quite reach me.
I'm sorry it's so messy and old, I say.
At least it's not haunted, Evie replies.
How can you tell?
I've been in haunted houses.
Chapter 23.
That night, I dreamed the dream. My mother was the first to die, while cooking saffron chicken and prawn paella with peas. My mother, with her wicked laugh, her soft spot for underdogs, her hatred of hypocrisy, a love for schoolteachers, dark chocolate and Bailey's ice cream. My mother with her posh phone voice and pink lipstick, potpourri-smelling lingerie drawer. Her bubble baths behind a locked door, no children allowed. My mother, who could make rice pudding from leftover boiled rice and made us each take turns to get the wishbone when we ate roast chicken. My mother, who grew up on a farm and had a pony called 12 because it was 12 hands high, yet who refused to let us have a dog because she still mourned the loss of her own beloved childhood pet, a boxer called Sinbad. On that night, she was standing in front of the freezer with a bag of frozen peas in her hand, when the knife scythed through her carotid artery, spilling green and red onto the white tiled floor. She had always complained about choosing white tiles, because they showed every spilled crumb, scuff mark, and dropped pea. The plume of blood sprayed in an arc across the kitchen bench, and the sink, and the cutlery drawer, which was open, and Tupperware boxes, which she always arranged neatly so she could find the lids when she needed them. The blood stretched all the way to the cat food bowl in the corner, where Tibbles would later lick it into a smear and track it across the floor with her paws. Dad was next. My father, who worked in property management, a fancy way of saying he collected rents and organised building leases. My father, who taught Elias how to drive and would get him to practice his parking outside a succession of pubs, whereupon Dad slipped inside for a quick half. The White Lion, the Last Post, the Beekeeper, and the Commercial Inn. Later, Dad would fall asleep on the sofa, snoring through Midsummer Murders. My father, who brewed his own beer, collected vinyl LPs, and once scored a golfing hole-in-one that ran all the way along the ground, but he still framed the scorecard. My father, who didn't like using the word hate, but instead said he disliked racists, reality TV shows, Manchester United, pistachios that don't open, and people who spend 15 minutes in a queue and don't know what to order when they get to the counter. Dad died on his hands and knees, crouching in front of the DVD player because one of the twins had managed to get a disc stuck in the machine. The knife severed his spine, paralysing him from the waist down. He managed to roll onto his back and hold up his arm, trying to ward off the blows, losing two fingers on his left hand and his right thumb. For a long while they couldn't find his thumb, because it had rolled under the TV cabinet. My twin sisters were doing their homework, or playing in the bedroom they shared. They must have known something was wrong, because they locked the door and barricaded it with beanbags and soft toys and a rocking horse that belonged to my grandmother and had no hair on its mane. April was the eldest by 20 minutes and always acted like an older sister. Earnest and bossy, she was the hoarder, the show-off, and the baker of cupcakes, partial to strawberry lip gloss and jelly snakes, and able to name every king and queen of England using a rhyme she'd learned off by heart. Esme was different. But the same, part of a collective child, or two halves with the same face, each slightly different but in symmetry. Esme, the shy, the meek, the songbird, with a dancer's grace and tiny feet. Esme, the peacemaker, the advocate, the knitter. Esme, who pressed flowers in the pages of her diary and gave names to every animal she ever met. Elias used an axe to break a hole through the door before reaching inside and turning the key. He tossed aside the rocking horse and the beanbags. April fell first, which followed the natural order of how the twins handled everything. She ran towards Elias, and the knife entered her ribs and came out near her spine. Blood splattered across the wallpaper and the bedspread, the bald rocking horse and the doll's house. Esme tried to crawl beneath her bed, but was dragged out by her ankles, scratching at the floor and bunching the rug under her body. I try not to imagine her fear, or the sound of metal on air, or metal on flesh, or the silence that followed. People always ask, where was I? At football practice, or on my way home. It was the second training session of the season, and my first year with the Sherwood Strikers. I had moved up to under-15s and felt a little overawed. We trained at Brelsford Park, about 2 miles from the house, or 10 minutes if I rode my bike along the towpath,
Mum had told me to be home by 6. She also told me not to even think about stopping for chips. Of course, I didn't listen. I hadn't eaten since lunchtime at school, and the fat fryer did a cone of chips for a quid, although I had to forgo the vinegar, or Mum would smell it on my breath. I scoffed the chips and still had time to ride past Ailsa Piper's house in the hope I might glimpse her in the garden or coming home from netball practice. Ailsa was a year older than me. I once helped her find a bracelet that she lost on her way to school. We hadn't spoken since then, but she always smiled when we bumped into each other. Happenstances that I tried to orchestrate as often as possible. Running late, I had to stand up on the pedals and push hard to make it home by 6. I wheeled my bike through the side gate and rested it up against the shed. Then I took off my muddy football boots and banged them against the back step. I could hear canned TV laughter coming from the front room as I opened the back door. I called out to Mum. She didn't answer. In my dream, this is where I wake, as I step into the kitchen, seeing the smear of blood near the litter box. I don't wake screaming or bolt upright in my bed, but my cheeks are sometimes wet and my voice hoarse. That's when I get up. That's when I run. On my second circuit of Willerton Park, a car pulls alongside me, slowing to my speed. Tires crunch over fallen leaves, acorns and seed pods. The window lowers. "You're not allowed to drive on the footpath," I say.
"I'm pursuing a suspect," says Lenny.
"What's he done?"
"He refuses to have a phone."
"That's hardly a crime."
"No, but it's bloody annoying."
Her wrist is draped over the steering wheel. Her collar is turned up. I kick ahead and take a shortcut past the playground. Lenny accelerates and catches up as I reach the lake. She pulls alongside me again.
"We have a problem."
"In my experience, whenever someone tells me they have a problem, they're trying to make their problem into mine."
"I need your help."
She looks tired. I wonder if, like me, she is kept awake by an unsettled mind or a past that will not stay buried. Slowing down, I walk to a nearby bench seat where I begin stretching, straightening each leg and bending my body over it until my forehead almost touches my shins. Out of her car, Lenny takes a seat next to me, wrapping her coat around her chest and slipping her hands in the pockets where keys and spare change jangle.
"The DNA tests are back,"
she says, taking out her chapstick and running it along her lips. "And?"
"The semen found in Jodie's hair belonged to Craig Farley."
"So that's it?"
"They also tested the second trace of semen found on her thigh, which was too degraded to get a complete profile, but enough to show that it didn't come from Farley."
"Jodie had sex earlier in the evening."
"Or Farley had an accomplice."
"Nothing else indicates a second perpetrator." Lenny scratches at her cheek, leaving a mark on her pale skin.
"Farley says he found Jodie in the woods. He says she was already unconscious."
"Do you believe him?"
"Of course not. He's a lying sack of shit. But the second semen sample worries me because it creates doubt. A good defense lawyer is going to ask why we haven't identified an accomplice, or a boyfriend, or another suspect. That's why we need to tighten up the case. Make sure Farley doesn't weasel his way out."
"What do you want me to do?"
"Review the evidence."
"In what capacity?"
"You work for the police."
"Part-time." Lenny ignores the distinction.
"Just look at the interviews with Farley and tell me if we missed anything."
"Can I talk to him face to face?"
"No. His lawyer claims we browbeat Farley into making a confession."
Lenny notices my look.
"Don't even go there. We followed procedure. Regular breaks, kid gloves."
She sounds annoyed at herself for being defensive. "Are you looking for anyone else?"
"Officially, no."
"And unofficially?"
"I'm keeping an open mind."
I've been standing still for too long and grown cold. Lenny offers to drive me home. In the car, she turns up the heater full blast and negotiates her way out of the park and onto the street. Silence hangs between us. Not a solid divide, but one that feels soft and familiar, like an old pair of slippers or a favourite sweater. Lenny has known me since I was 13,
and she was in her early 20s. Since then, she has been my greatest supporter and harshest critic. A stepmother, rebellious aunt, friend, sounding board, and the person who knows me best.
I had an interesting call from Child and Family Services the other day, she says, as the car pulls up in front of the house. Seems that someone listed me as a referee on a foster care application.
I stay silent.
Apparently this person wants to foster a young lass with behavioural problems. I took it as a prank call at first. I still think it might be.
It's not, I say, opening the car door.
I hear she's a nightmare.
She's fine.
Have you any idea what you're doing?
I hope so.
It's not easy to look after a teenager.
I used to be one.
You skipped those years,
says Lenny, flippantly. But I know she's right. What did you tell them? I ask.
I told them you didn't torture kittens or shoot dolphins.
Thank you. Lenny leans forward and peers out of the windscreen at the overgrown garden and filthy windows.
You should sell this place. It's too much for you.
Maybe I'll foster more kids. She knows I'm joking. Leaning behind her, she produces a padded envelope from the back seat. Inside are 6 DVDs.
22 hours of interviews. Finish that lot, and you'll need a shower or a noose.
Chapter 24.
Can I help you?
Asks the salesman at Dreamtime Warehouse. His name is Brad, and he has shaved the sides of his head, but left hair on the top to grow untrammelled like weeds on a new allotment.
I'm looking for a bed, I say.
Well, you've come to the right place.
I wonder for a moment whether Brad is being facetious, but his smile seems genuine. We're standing in a showroom the size of several tennis courts, surrounded by mattresses, bases, ensembles, and assorted bunks.
What size are you looking for?
He asks.
Single, small double, double, king-sized, or super king-size?
Right. Maybe a single bed.
Is it for you, sir?
No.
A child?
A young woman.
And are you replacing an existing bed?
Yes.
And does the young lady have a small bedroom?
It's bigger than her last one.
Then perhaps she might prefer something larger, a double.
Okay.
I'm fascinated by Brad's hair, which sways in the opposite direction when he moves his head.
What type do you have in mind?
He asks.
We have platform, panel, sleigh, trundle, poster, canopy, futon, wooden, brass, wrought iron.
Just a regular bed, something standard.
May I suggest a mattress and base combination? Perhaps in our Slumberland range, which is on offer?
He walks me across the showroom, and we stop at a row of 4 beds.
That one, I say, pointing.
Excellent. Now, let's talk about the mattress.
Doesn't it come with a mattress?
Brad laughs, as though I'm being droll.
You get to choose, sir. You can have open spring, pocket spring, memory foam, latex.
What do most people buy?
Pocket spring is the more luxurious. It's made from small individual springs, each housed in a pocket of fabric. This means the springs move independently, providing more support so that when you roll over, you're not disturbing your partner.
That's what I'll have.
Soft, medium, or firm.
Dear Mother of God.
Perhaps you'd like to try the difference,
says Brad, pointing to the mattresses.
Don't worry about your shoes. We have mattress protectors.
I'm expected to lie down. I feel like a corpse in a coffin. Brad is still talking.
Feel how it supports your hips and shoulders and lower back. It's particularly good when one partner is significantly heavier than the other.
We're not partners.
Oh, I see. Perhaps you should bring her along. Let her choose. We're open 7 days a week.
I don't collect her until Friday, I say.
Brad's smile disappears, like a light being switched off.
I'm getting her room ready, I say, trying to recover. She's getting out. I mean, she's coming to live with me.
I see,
says Brad, although I don't think he sees at all. I'll take a medium mattress. Can it be delivered?
You haven't asked the price.
How much is it?
Normally, you'd pay well over £1,000, but I can do it for £699.
The shock must register on my face.
It's very good value, sir. People spend far more money on a sofa that gets used for a few hours a day, whereas a bed gives us a crucial 8 hours.
Fine.
What about a mattress protector?
No, thank you.
You'll need linen and a duvet.
He takes me to another section of the showroom and begins to list the different cottons and thread counts. The information washes over me, and I become aware of how many extra things I will have to buy before Evie arrives. Soap and shower gel for her bathroom. Toilet paper. What about women's things? She'll need tampons or pads. I've never had to buy those. Will Evie bring some with her? I could ask someone. Caroline Fairfax, perhaps. No. I've had enough embarrassment for one day. I stop for takeaway on the drive home, because I have nothing in the fridge except leftovers that are covered in a greenish fur. I'll need to cook proper meals when Evie arrives. The extra responsibility will be good for me. I'll make shopping lists and eat better food. Healthy shit. I'll drink less and won't put my feet on the furniture or cut my toenails at the kitchen table. I'll have to share the TV remote and listen to her music. What if Evie wants my favourite chair? Maybe I haven't thought this through. Then again, I'm too young to be set in my ways. I'll learn things about myself. We'll learn things together. After rinsing my plate, I carry another beer to the library and search my desk drawer for a writing pad and a fountain pen. I can't remember the last time I wrote a proper letter, on paper, with an envelope. I don't know if this will ever reach Sasha Hopewell, but I have to try. Dear Sasha, I hope you don't mind me using first names. I'm Cyrus, by the way. We haven't met, but I asked your parents to pass this letter on to you. If you're reading it, then I thank them. I trust I didn't frighten them when I visited. It wasn't intended. Your parents tried to explain to me why you left home and keep moving from place to place. I still don't fully understand what happened, but I saw the depth of their pain and how much they were missing you. I'm a psychologist working in Nottinghamshire. Several weeks ago, I met a young woman in council care. I can't tell you her name because it's the subject of a court order, but you'll know exactly who I mean when I say that she was found hiding in a secret room in a house in North London 6 years ago. She is a remarkable young woman, but also a very troubled one. You appear to be one of the few people she has ever learned to trust, which is why I'm reaching out to you. I'm hoping you might talk to me about those early days with Angel Face. Did she mention having a family? Did she hint at memories of her childhood? A place or a favourite toy? Brothers or sisters? I know you've been asked these questions dozens of times before, but I'm hoping with the clarity of hindsight you might have remembered something else. I don't have a phone number. It's a long story. But I'm including my address and my pager number. I don't need to know where you are, or what you're doing, or why you're staying away, unless you want to talk about those things. Contact me, please. I guarantee complete discretion. Yours sincerely, Cyrus Haven.
Chapter 25. Angel Face.
When are you leaving?
Asks Davina, nudging my shoulder. Friday.
You excited?
I don't know what I am. We're setting up the tables for breakfast in the morning. One of my chores, putting out bowls and spoons and boxes of cereal, refilling sauce bottles and checking the salt and pepper shakers. The dining room smells of chip fat, boiled cauliflower, and, for some inexplicable reason, carpet shampoo, even though the floor is tiled.
Why him?
Asks Davina.
Who? Dr. Haven. You ran away from all those other foster families, but this guy pops up and you say yes.
It's different.
How?
He understands, I say, which sounds lame. I don't know the reason. Maybe I've grown up. Maybe I'm sick of this place. Maybe I'll run the first chance I get.
We're going to miss you,
says Davina.
Liar. Don't do that.
What?
People are allowed to tell lies, especially when they're trying to be polite.
I can see her point, but why change the habit of a lifetime? I don't mind doing kitchen duty. Whenever I get anxious, I get these bouts of OCD, although Guthrie calls them CDO, which is just like OCD except in alphabetical order. My compulsion is to clean and put things in order. I once broke into the pantry, not to steal food, but to check the use-by dates and arrange all the tins with their labels facing outwards. Nobody caught me. I did it again a few weeks later. I broke in, but the pantry was still so neat that I messed it up. I figured I could fix it the next night, but they caught me on the way out. Sod's law. Davina doesn't mind my obsessions. She has a little boy at home, Oscar. He's 4. She talks about him.